Here's what's coming up in the Category5.tv newsroom. Governments in the UK, US, and Australia have asked Facebook in an open letter to roll back plans to bring end-to-end encryption to all of its platforms. Google is showing off stunning new augmented reality features coming to web and mobile apps soon. After analyzing a database containing 3 billion leaked credentials from security breaches, the Microsoft threat research team determined that more than 44 million user accounts had a serious security problem. We'll tell you what you need to know. And Intel is making LiDAR affordable with a new palm-sized camera. Stick around, the full details are coming up later in the show.
This is the Category5.tv newsroom, covering the week's top tech stories with a slight Linux bias.
I'm Sasha Rickman, joined this week by Jeff Weston and Robbie Ferguson.
All right, here's some quick honorable mentions this week. Larry Page and Sergey Brin, co-founders of Google, have stepped down from their positions as its CEO and president, respectively, with immediate effect at its parent company of Alphabet, Inc. However, both will continue their involvement as co-founders, shareholders, and members of Alphabet's board of directors. Going forward, Sundar Pichai, Google's chief executive, will become the CEO of both Google and Alphabet. He will assume the role of managing Alphabet's investments in its portfolio of other bets in areas including self-driving cars and life sciences. Besides this, he will also remain a member of Alphabet's board of directors. The stepping down of Page and Brin represents the end of an era for Google that was founded by both in 1998 while they were PhD students at Stanford University. Despite not holding important management roles at Alphabet, the two plan to continue talking with Pichai regularly. And Mexican cops have pre-ordered a fleet of Cybertrucks. Having pre-ordered 15 Tesla Cybertrucks, that makes the Mexican city of San Luis Potosí the second to share plans to put police officers in Cybertrucks following Dubai's announcement a couple weeks back. The San Luis Potosí government is reportedly interested in replacing its internal combustion engine vehicles with the truck to cut down on maintenance costs and save money in the long run. Adrian Esper Cardenas, mayor of San Luis Potosí, described the purchase as, quote, common sense, end quote. He added that the city will also use some of the 15 trucks for tasks like picking up trash around the city. It would be simple for the city to reverse course if it changes its mind, because all it takes to pre-order a truck is a fully refundable $100 deposit. That way, if the police force gets cold feet and it thinks that the trucks are not quite meatball-proof windows, it could still completely black out before actually buying Tesla's trucks.
Let's get into the top stories we're following this week. Governments in the UK, US, and Australia have asked Facebook in an open letter to roll back plans to bring end-to-end encryption to all of its platforms. Facebook, who has been the center of many privacy scandals, responds that everyone has the right to a private conversation. It's the latest in a battle between privacy and safety, which has been played out between governments and tech firms ever since digital communication became mass market. End-to-end encryption is a secure way of sending information so that only the intended receiver can read it. The information is encrypted while it is still on the sender's device and is only decrypted when it reaches the person intended. Nobody, not even the platform owner, has the keys to unlock it. The UK and the US have just signed a historic agreement to give each other much faster access to private conversations, cutting down the time from months or years to weeks or days. But that agreement could potentially be rendered a bit useless if the messages are encrypted. Setting up a government backdoor is not the answer either, as Amnesty International pointed out, quote, proposals for a backdoor have repeatedly been shown to be unworkable. There is no middle ground. If law enforcement is allowed to circumvent encryption, then anybody can, end quote. Professor Alan Woodward, a security expert at the University of Surrey and a consultant to Europol, gave a good analogy when he said, quote, a backdoor is rather like leaving a key under the mat. Once somebody knows it's there, anyone can walk in, end quote.
Interesting story.
I really think that this is going to sound weird. Okay, so I know that emails are not private. Mm-hmm. And I assume that Facebook messages are not private. So I don't think that they should be. They should not be private.
But it's not because they're private. Not. They because shouldn't be.
It's not about private. It's about encryption. And so I think the issue in this case is the fact that when there is legal proceedings going on and the police are doing investigations, and a lot of times it could be a national security issue. It could be a police investigation that is about a safety or, you know, like drug runners or whatever. The fact that the police need to be able to access those devices. I mean, we saw this a couple of years ago with Apple and their security needing the fingerprints. And unless you had, you know, the person's thumbprint, you couldn't get past the encryption, all that kind of stuff. And so there's always been this battle on the encryption front of can law enforcement get access to it and what is acceptable and what is not. And so, I mean, at the beginning, there was this idea of, yes, for sure, we could, you know, I think it makes sense for law enforcement to have encryption. But then as soon as you get things like, you know, the Edward Snowden and all of that kind of breach that's coming out through that scandal, you have people going, hold on, we can't trust you with that information. Mm-hmm. We can't trust you to follow the court process properly where you're supposed to go to a judge. Now you're bypassing that with, you know, fake warrants to make it happen. I think that's how it played out, if my memory serves. And so now people are going, I don't think we can trust you with the encryption. You know, and it's, I mean, the story is an interesting point because you're right. If you do give that access, then anybody has access as long as they can get to that if they know the key. Is that bottom line?
Here's where the tricky thing is in my mind, and maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but when I first had a phone, it was on a party line.
Okay.
So there was no privacy, right? Anybody could pick up.
Yeah.
There was no privacy. I don't understand
it's
what this is.
It's a little bit different now, though.
It's different, but it really...
Oh, all the kids listening tonight. party line.
Party line. That's right.
So we just dated ourselves. Is
why one person needs to have another conversation with another person and have it completely locked down. I feel like that was never a thing. We never had that.
But you also didn't use your party line for, you know, international terrorism.
Right. And if I were to be using my party line for international terrorism, I'd want it to be encrypted. So
exactly.
I don't think it should be encrypted at all. Yeah.
No, I understand.
Yes.
I mean, it really comes down to and I hear this argument all the time. If you're not doing anything wrong, why do you care?
Yes.
And I get that argument. It makes sense. If you're not doing anything wrong, why should you care? But the fact is, there's still the potential that you might not be doing anything wrong. But now if somebody decides they're going to investigate you, anything that you're doing is no longer going to be protected.
But if I work under the assumption that nothing is private, I'm not going to do anything in these weird realms that I would hope to stay private.
Right, but where is that line? And I think that's what this story comes to, is where is the line between acceptable, and I don't want to say intrusion, but that really is what it comes down to. If you're going to break the encryption, it is an element of intrusion. Might be for good means, but where's that acceptable line between intrusion and privacy? And, you know, I don't know if there's a safe answer, because you're always going to have two sides of the story. You're going to have the privacy side, and you're going to have the law enforcement side, and then there's going to be people in the middle going, I don't know.
Yeah,
it's interesting to watch how this is playing out in the courts, and I think where it's going to really come to head and you're going to start seeing movement in a definitive way is in the European courts. Because of all of the legislation that they're putting in place, I think that's where, if there's going to be a breakthrough that allows for that healthy balance, I think Europe is where you're going to see it.
All right. Google is showing off stunning new augmented reality features coming to web and mobile apps soon. Google has been quietly working to improve its augmented reality platform, Arcor, since its official launch early last year. Now the company says it's ready to unveil some of the next generation upgrades to depth detection and physics that they've achieved, promising to make AR experiences seem much more realistic in the near future. The upgrades, part of Arcor's all new depth API, will soon allow developers to perform what's known as occlusion, which is when an artificial object can be blocked from view by real-world objects in a scene. Place a virtual cat in your living room, for instance, and you can see it disappear from view when you angle your camera in a way that places a bed or a table or some other object in between. The result is a more believable scene because the depth detection going on under the hood means that your smartphone better understands every object in a scene and how far apart each object is from one another. Google says that it's able to do this through optimizing existing software so that you won't need to buy a new phone with a specific sensor or a type of processor. If you have a phone that supports R-Core, which is pretty much every new Android phone released in the last few years, you'll be able to access these new features directly on the device with no help from the cloud. Pokemon Go creator Niantic showed off a video of an occlusion demo featuring a tiny virtual Pikachu darting around an urban plaza, dashing in between objects and blending seamlessly in with the environment. That was in July 2018. But it was just a video and not a demo running on a device in real time. Google says the advancements will be made available to developers in the future after it works more closely with developers and other collaborators to polish off some of its approaches. These go beyond occlusion and into more realistic physics and 3D mapping. Google has developed a way for AR objects to interact with the real world more realistically, move through the environment in a way a real-world 3D object would, and interact with surfaces like you might expect physical matter would. The company doesn't have a timeline for when it does expect to release this tool set more broadly, but it's likely these capabilities will be showing up in apps and AR web experiences sometime next year.
This is cool.
This is cool.
I mean, as you're reading the story, I'm going, what in the world would I use this for? But I think this can take things like AR games to a whole new level. And I can also see this being the beginnings of a whole new way of doing living AR visual wear.
Right.
So, for instance, I mean, if you go back to that episode of Star Trek Next Generation, I think the episode was called The Game, where they had that little headset, and as they're walking around, there's like these balls and, you know, where they're throwing the balls into these cyclones and all that kind of stuff. I can see this opening up the door to having, you know, VR goggles that instead of having that opaque screen, having a transparent screen, so that it changes the way you do your games.
So you would really like this.
I think this is really fascinating how they're moving it forward. My fear, though, is that, you know, as humans, we can't be trusted. Somebody's going to get hurt.
Okay, here's what I like it for. I like it for two reasons that immediately popped into my head. One, randomly, interior design. I feel like you can easily then show somebody what their space could look like.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could do that now, though.
Yeah, but it would be easier.
Not with occlusion, though.
Right, I mean, not with occlusion.
Like, that's true, yeah.
Second, I think therapy for people with phobias or PTSD, I think that would work.
That's an interesting concept. Yeah. I haven't thought about that one.
Yeah, and also games.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's the way it's going to go initially is, you know, people are going to go, how can we build this into games?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, that's interesting about mobility issues. This does open a whole new realm of how does that play into, say, urban planning?
Right.
And if you develop an AI map and you look at it going, okay, you know, how would people interact with this? What would be the movement? Like, take, for instance, like Times Square.
Yeah.
It's like, how, you know, if this happened, how would that impact traffic? And watching these AI people walk around by throwing an object in there, or if you just place, I realize it's kind of backwards use of it, but it'd be interesting to see from a traffic model standpoint or a construction model, the impact that this would have, you know, could change the way we do the world.
Yeah. We agree.
Yes.
And on that note, we've got to take a quick break. The Crypto Corner and more of this week's top tech stories are coming up. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back to the Crypto Corner, and another week has flown by. Not many changes within the price or the market cap
of our industry is still around 200 billion. Market share of Bitcoin is around 66%. So not many changes there. But as usual, a lot of things to report about. And so the first big one is Ethereum upgraded this weekend to Istanbul, which means a bit more performant, cheaper, and a bit more resilient. But it's not the big upgrade to Ethereum 2.0. That will come, hopefully, beginning of next year. The next one is Litecoin. The Litecoin Foundation created a trust fund to address privacy issues by using the Mimblewimble protocol, which is great news because that's exactly what we also need in the Bitcoin protocol. An interesting statistic is decentralized finance, or as they say it in modern English, DeFi, on the Ethereum network. That was in 1997 around $10 million. Last month it was $650 million. So an exponential growth in decentralized finance on the Ethereum blockchain. The $650 million, by the way, is equivalent to around 2% of all ETH available in the market. So it's significant. Then the Voice network, which is an EOS-based media platform, competitor. They want to be competitor to Facebook and so on. They will launch their beta version soon. That's interesting because Block One, that is the company behind this system, they generated $4 billion during the ICO of EOS. So they've got a lot of money that they can throw behind this year. And last but not least, in the news section is British Virgin Islands. They announced that they're converting their US-backed dollar to a digital currency. So that's the next one, that country that will have their currency on a blockchain. Now, subject of the week is exchange. And why an exchange? Because you can make a lot of mistakes there if you don't choose the right exchange. And there are four things that you have to be really careful with when choosing an exchange. First, is it a regulated exchange? And to give you an example, there's an exchange called IDAX, I-D-A-X, that's based in Mongolia. So you know that if something happens there, you have got no chance in recovering your money. I assume that. And with that, you have to be careful that with every other exchange that you have got at least a chance to talk to somebody. And that's usually the case with regulated exchanges. Second is it a KYC AML exchange? So are they asking you for the passport picture? Don't send those things to companies or exchanges or websites you've never heard of, or you don't have any idea who's sitting behind that exchange. Yeah, because you never know what they're going to do with your passport or your driver's license. What are they going to do with your data? Is it safely stored? You don't know that. So make sure that you you've got an answer to that question. Third is so-called fake trading or wash trading, which is forbidden in the US and in Europe, but it's allowed in Asia. And that means that the exchange is faking trade volume. They're saying that around 90% of Bitcoin's volume that you see on CoinMarketCap, it's around $1 billion. The reality, it's only around 100 million. So make sure that there's enough liquidity of your token or coin. And last is the fees. Just be careful with the fees. Check that before you do a trade. It can be up to 30% high, 30% high, if you make a mistake. So those are the four points you need to consider when choosing the right exchange for your token. And that's for me. So I wish you a great week and see you next week. Thanks for watching.
Thanks, Robert. Just a reminder, this is not financial advice. We're just sharing what's happening in the crypto market.
The Microsoft threat research team analyzed billions of login credentials that had been leaked following security breaches. These came from multiple sources, including law enforcement and publicly accessible databases. Considering the data breaches are known to have exposed 4.1 billion records in the first 6 months of 2019 alone, there's obviously plenty of this kind of credential data floating around, and plenty that is traded across dark web markets. Security researchers analyzed this breach data, and by doing so, it's possible to get an idea of the most commonly reused and therefore insecure passwords. The Microsoft Identity Threat Research Team was also looking for these compromised credentials to cross-check against the Microsoft user ecosystem. Across just the first 3 months of 2019, Microsoft found some 44 million accounts that were reusing passwords found within those breached credential databases. You might think that 44 million reused passwords out of more than 3 billion breached credentials isn't too bad a percentage. Unless you're one of those Azure AD or Microsoft account holders with the password problem, of course. It's dangerous to think that you are safe just because you don't use any of the headline passwords mentioned in the most reused passwords list that regularly appears online, as threat actors use a variety of techniques to reveal login credentials. If one of your passwords turns up in a breach database and you use it to access your email account, for example, it's often game over as far as your security is concerned. Microsoft warns about how this data is commonly used in what's known as a breach replay attack. Quote, once a threat actor gets a hold of a spilled credentials or credentials in the wild, they can try to execute a breach replay attack. In this attack, the actor tries out the same credentials on different service accounts to see if there's a match. End quote. As far as the leaked credentials that the threat research team found during this analysis are concerned, Microsoft has confirmed that consumers need to take, quote, no additional action, end quote, as they are already forced a password reset. So what can we do to protect our accounts? The report goes on to say, quote, our numbers show that 99.9% of identity attacks have been thwarted by turning on multi-factor authentication, end quote.
Wow. 99.9% have been thwarted.
So we know I am not the best with my passwords. I know that.
You're learning.
I'm learning. And yeah. I know I would never have known how bad I was if not for this show. But now I know I need multi-factor authentication. I'm going to need it because right, yeah. I know that even if I think I have the safest password out there, there's a computer out there that's just picking away and will one day figure it out.
Well, and do you know what's neat about multi-factor authentication, Sasha, is that even if you have a weak password,
yeah.
if you have MFA or 2FA, whatever you want to call it, then you're much more protected because they only have that one factor. They only have the password. Well, they also need your phone or your right. SMS or whatever else,
so I
right?
can go back to passwords I can remember.
In some regards, absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, as long as it's only for one site.
Yes, that's fine with me.
Yeah, you don't want to repeat passwords across multiple sites.
But even if you were to repeat passwords and have multi-factor authentication, you'd be okay. I mean, right. you don't want to, but you'd be okay.
Yeah.
Right?
It is concerning that people still continue to use the same password, but I would venture to guess that almost every one of those people do not have some sort of a password keeper software.
I would say you're wrong. And here's why I know, because I am one of those people.
But most people maybe it's have just, the same password because it's easy to remember.
It's poor practice,
it's
though.
Bad
maybe
practice.
It's just bad
easy.
Practice.
Okay, so here's what happens is... I try a password and it says wrong password. Or I try a password and it says your password's expired. You have to come up with a new password. And I just, in a rush, put in a password that I know, you know?
Oh, Sasha.
And then I think I'll come back to that later and I'll change it.
Yeah, you never do.
I don't. I have a problem. And my problem is...
Well, admitting it is the first step.
Right. So,
this is Passwords Anonymous, a.k.a. PA. We're going to call this PA.
When I use a password generator, which I have done, which has rendered my laptop useless in this moment.
No, that was you.
That was me. Yep. Okay. Yeah. But like, I use a password generator, and there's this big, long string of characters that I just copy-paste into things, right?
Which is great. What a wonderful world, as far as security goes, if none of the users know their passwords. Think about that. You think that sounds crazy, but that is the perfect scenario.
Yes. Yeah,
if I fire a staff member, and they, because they've compromised data, or they've done something wrong, I don't want them to be able to walk away with passwords that they remember.
Exactly.
I promise you, I don't know any of my own personal passwords right now.
That's great.
My master password on my password thing.
That's the way it should be.
Yes. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, but then there is the scenario that you've encountered, Sasha, where your Chromebook, you have to log into your Chromebook. So you have to know your Chrome password, which is your Google password, right?
Right.
So the trick is to have a simple enough password that you remember. So I use password recipes, not passwords. So you think about a recipe. We've talked about that on the show before, and I'll talk about it again. But knowing your recipe, you're able to punch in your password. So my password is like this big, long thing because it's like all these different factors for a recipe for my password. And so it's like a hacker could never figure it out. It's all kinds of words and punctuations and everything else. But I remember it because I know the recipe.
Right.
And then in addition to that, I have multi-factor authentication enabled on my Google account. So even though I have a password that I'm entering in because I remember the recipe. So think about this. What if that computer had a keylogger? What if I was logging into my Google account to check my Gmail from a library computer where someone has installed a keylogger?
Right.
Now they know my password.
Right.
So now do they have access to my Google account? No. They don't have my phone because I've got multi-factor authentication enabled. So every time I try to log into my Google account or my Chromebook, it pops up on my phone. Do you want to authorize this? Yes. It's a simple click. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You need to enable that.
I want that now.
Yeah.
I will say, as far as the key logger thing goes, that I would never fall victim to that because I don't know my passwords and I just copy paste. So they would only be logging the copy and the paste.
But there are clipboard loggers as well.
Yeah. Of course there are.
Yes, of course. Yep. You have to have multi-factor authentication.
Two-factor authentication multi-factor authentication. That's for the win.
Mm-hmm. I wish there was a way, and I suppose in theory it could be done, but I wish when there was a data breach for a company that there would be a way to purge the passwords and ensure that your password keeper software would prevent you from ever using that again. Like, I know with
Wouldn't
mine, I get alerts.
We're almost there, Jeff.
I know for mine, I get alerts that it runs an audit of all my passwords. Because at this point, I'm now up over probably 250 different passwords. And it's like, by the way, you've reused this a couple times. Now, and when I look at it, it's like, oh, that's a site I haven't logged into in 10 years. Mm-hmm. Like, clearly, I don't use it anymore.
But it's the same password that you're using on something that you use every day.
Well,
which is the scary thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But it'd be nice if there was a way to wipe them out and never allow you to use it again.
Yeah. That comes down to common sense, though.
I know.
And what we are at, like with MyKey, so MYKI, for example, with LastPass, with Have I Been Owned as examples, Google Chrome now features it built in. When passwords that you use have been compromised, you receive alerts that let you know. And in fact, I recently received an alert that one of my passwords was compromised. I recognized it because it said, this is your password. And so, oh yeah, my password has been compromised. So what did I do? I did a dump of my LastPass password database, and I searched for that password, and I found all of the sites that I use that I had stupidly shared the same password with because it was one of my plain text passwords.
Right.
And I had found about maybe 6 or 7 sites where I had used this password from years ago. And so I went through check, 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 check. and I changed the password on every single one of those sites to a nice strong password.
Yes.
So now, whether it was compromised or not, that password is now secure. What I am not able to protect against is the fact that the data that they were able to accumulate during that breach, they now have access to. So that could be the phone call that comes in and says, "Hi, we're calling from Microsoft and we're looking at your computer." Like, that could be any kind of phishing scam, spear phishing scam, whatever it may be, because they now have data on me. However, my password is no longer an issue. So right. They can't get access to my accounts.
That actually helps me to know that you've actually had the same problem I have.
Everyone does, Sasha. Oh, but the thing is that you've got to take action.
Yes.
So where I receive the notification that my password has been compromised, I found the 6 other sites that used that password because I had shared that password with other sites, and I changed the password.
Right.
And what you said is very crucial, because in your news story, Sasha, you said that they're now using the compromised data in order to do a secondary attack.
Yes.
To see if maybe that password that you used on MySpace way back in the day might be the same password that you're now using on Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
and so they try those things.
Of
they
course.
Attack those things. And you would be none the wiser until finally they get in. And guess what they do? They change your password. And then you can't access your account.
Yeah.
Right.
And
so you've got to be proactive.
And I will say, like, the password generators that generate these really strong, mm-hmm. awesome passwords, they're amazing.
Yeah.
But I think every single person has generated their own password that they're super proud of, and they kind of feel a little bit of attachment to.
Yeah.
Right? And then you kind of want to use it, but you shouldn't.
Yeah. and I think the thing that we hesitate with is that these big long passwords that are 64 characters long, how will I ever remember that? And the key point is, you don't need to know it.
Yes.
You don't need to remember it. You need to have a password manager that is able to input that into the login form so that it will get you into the system, and you never need to know that password.
Exactly.
That's the key point.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. Now,
yes.
I know we have to move on,
but
one quick thought with this. I mean, I'm thinking about what you're saying, Robbie, about the replay attacks where they're checking out other sites.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that you have two-factor authentication. So take, for instance, Facebook. You can have your two-factor authentication, whereas if they get in, they change the password, but they can also now change the cell phone that you use for your two-factor authentication. So once they're in,
then
they can now change that cell, that number, so that when you
anything.
Go, "Oh, I'm locked out."
Jeff, we're talking about social media here. What about banking?
Mm-hmm.
Well, exactly.
Where are the funds going to go that they now have access to?
Right.
Right.
So is there a way, and maybe they're doing this already, but I'm thinking for a sophisticated web service, whether it be banking or whatever, is there a way for them to put in almost three-factor authentication with some smart trends? For instance, they recognize that normally you log in from an IP address that's in a specific area of the country. Suddenly, you log in with your password from an IP address totally somewhere else, and then they instantly go to change your phone number. Would the site go, "You're in, that's not you, we're locking you out"?
Well, this is exactly why we use the term multi-factor authentication, not necessarily two-factor authentication, right? So multi-factor authentication could be 5 factors, right? When I log in, if I want to remote into the studio from home, there are 3 or 4 factors, I think. So it's multi-factor authentication anyway. So it's not two-factor authentication. It takes 4 factors in order for me to get into the studio.
Huh.
So, yeah, there's... But as far as the lockdowns go, I mean, that's firewalling. That's a whole other can of worms. Yeah.
That'll be in a news story next week.
I know.
Yeah.
You just need to stupid-proof people. That's the problem.
Intel is adding a tiny LiDAR sensor to its RealSense range, claiming the Intel RealSense LiDAR camera L515 is the world's smallest laser rangefinder, not to mention one of the most affordable. Taking technology familiar from autonomous cars and robotics, the L515 then packages it down into a small enough form factor that it could allow compact smart devices to scan the world in 3D. LiDAR works by using a rapidly scanning laser, bouncing points of light off surrounding objects. By measuring the time taken for that light to reflect back, it can create a 3D map or point cloud of the world around that sensor. That accuracy has made it the centerpiece of many self-driving car projects, among other fields. Traditionally, though, LiDAR has been hamstrung by two key factors: size and price. Early LiDAR sensors, particularly those with suitable range for automotive applications, have been huge, like a spinning trash can mounted on top of the vehicle's roof. They've also cost tens of thousands of dollars or more. Intel's L515 taps into the growing category of solid-state LiDAR, however, and it's cheap enough at arriving just at $349.
Wow.
The chip maker developed its own tiny micro-electromechanical system, or MEMS, mirror that allows the laser to scan the scene but at reduced power. Despite requiring less than 3.5 watts, Intel says that the L515 can still track 3D objects at a range of up to 30 feet at over 23 million accurate depth pixels per second, with a depth resolution of 1024 by 768 at 30 frames per second. Arguably more exciting, though, is the potential for new applications and new users where LiDAR has traditionally been out of reach. Smoothing that transition is the fact that the L515 uses the same RealSense SDK 2.0 as Intel's other current RealSense cameras, released under an open source license and compatible with Windows, Linux, Android, and macOS, along with multiple platforms including Unity, Unreal, and even Python.
Unreal. Oh, man. Do you guys remember the first time that we heard of LiDAR?
Yes!
The Monkey Kingdom book.
Yes!
It was
the Lost City of the Monkey God, right?
Oh, the Monkey God. That's right. Not Monkey Kingdom.
Yes. The plane's most distinctive features are two struts or booms that extend behind the wings. Once a cheerful red and white, the paint job on this plane was full of patches and strips that had peeled off, and an ugly streak of oil ran down the fuselage from the forward engine. A big green LiDAR box almost filled the interior of the plane. Think about the size of this thing.
That is,
right?
Yeah. That is,
but I mean, that was some pretty sophisticated LiDAR.
Yeah.
This is too, though.
I'm not done.
Oh, okay.
This sleek, advanced, this sleek, advanced, and costly piece of technology, so top secret that it had to be guarded by soldiers, was being schlepped around in a shabby flying tin can, or so it seemed to my inexpert eye. That's Douglas Preston from The Lost City of the Monkey God. He was here on the show to talk about that.
My all-time favorite episodes. Yeah. If you have
was that season 9?
I don't know, Jeff.
It feels like it was yesterday.
Just go to our website, category5.tv, click on search, and click in Lost City of the Monkey God. You'll find it.
Which first made us excited about LiDAR. Yes.
I think so. Absolutely.
This story,
the technology,
brings LiDAR to us, right? Mm-hmm. This was exciting that it existed and that it was capable and useful in real-world applications.
But right. Douglas Preston went to the City of the Monkey God with a plane full of LiDAR technology, and now it's fitting in something that's like 60 millimeters.
Right. What can you use that for, I wonder?
First thing I thought of?
AR.
3D movies.
3D
Not
movies?
3D the way we have it now.
Interactive 3D movies.
3D movies. Could you imagine?
No, like, I can't.
Take, for instance, like an Avengers movie,
mm-hmm.
but it's filmed with 3D LiDAR technology.
Mm-hmm.
So not only can you be watching,
my.
But you're sitting there going, hold on. Oh, check out the other side of that fight.
Okay.
Like, that would be cool.
Combine that with the technology that Android is bringing about that allows things to go behind other objects.
Right.
Yeah.
And now we've got LiDAR to show us those objects in 3D space.
Well, remember we had the story with the cane that like was a smart cane that could have a conversation with you about what was around? What if that cane had LiDAR on it? I mean, it would just make it that much more attuned to what obstacles are in the way.
So could this be something, I mean, we've gone from mega server that fills a room to something that fills a box to something that fits in the pocket. Now we've got LiDAR that fills a plane that now fills like a 62 millimeter device. And now can it fit into my optics, for example, so that I can do augmented reality? Like, is this, everything is getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah, and I mean, the interesting applications from a, say, a security or an investigation standpoint, like, could you imagine all vehicles or cell phones, whatever, are clipped or equipped with LiDAR through this technology? And I granted, this is, we're talking about this size. Eventually, we're probably going to get much smaller.
That's it.
But imagine if you can get LiDAR onto a cell phone.
Yes.
And you get into a car accident. And the first thing you do when you pull out is you go, ping, and you LiDAR the entire accident scene.
Holy cow, dude. Have you ever seen like the 3D version of Google Earth? Like, imagine if your phone had LiDAR capabilities, because that's where we're going. And you could take a picture and all of a sudden you can put that in VR space.
Yes.
Sasha, you can put on your VR headset and you can be in that realm.
Right.
See, and I'm thinking from search and rescue standpoint.
Yeah.
Like, imagine if phones were equipped with LiDAR. I mean, like, we have the Amber Alert system.
Mm-hmm.
What if knowing, you know, so-and-so has been kidnapped or they're missing, but using a UUID through a government database, they go, boom, let's run a LiDAR scan.
You know what? That's all fine and good, but I'm thinking more, what about family? What about people that I love that have passed on? That I can enter a virtual reality space and walk into think about this, the video of an anniversary party or a birthday party, and actually, like, through VR be able to enter it, because LiDAR gives the capability for my VR to be able to interact with the video in such a way that it sees the depth. And then we integrate this capability of things to go behind objects and things, so I can walk around a live, not a live, but a video scene.
Yeah, there's always that, like, point of heartbreak when you, like, for example, Dave and I are renovating his family home in Newfoundland. And there's that point where it's a heartbreak because he has to take down some of his old memories, like his old childhood bedroom is painted in these beautiful Smurf, you know, collage sort of things.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it have been awesome to be able to do like a LiDAR and be able to walk through that?
Yeah.
As opposed to just.
But will LiDAR pick up color? Like, I don't think LiDAR's.
Well, you see, no, Jeff, you're missing it. You're combining LiDAR technology, so depth with the visual. So you've got 360 video plus LiDAR. Right? Yeah. So this is all part of the video. So now, not only can I look around in VR, which we can already do, okay? I can already take a 360 video. I have 360 cameras here. You're welcome to borrow them. And you can then look around in VR space. But with LiDAR, I can walk around in that VR space. Consider the difference.
With LiDAR filming, say, going back to the original idea that I mentioned about movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sitting here going, okay, throw on a VR headset. Suddenly, we're now in, like, Star Trek holodeck realms.
Yes.
Like, well, but not interactive.
No, not
physically.
Interactive, but I mean, but from the standpoint of, you know, if you could build, like, you know, say you walk around New York City and you LiDAR the city.
Yeah.
I mean,
this is what Google's already doing.
There, but suddenly you now have, like, VR tours where, you know, maybe somebody has mobility issues and it's like, I can't get to New York.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I'm thinking of my in-laws who are from Holland.
Yeah,
my mom would love to go back to Holland, but because of health issues, she can't get on the plane.
I love the idea.
So how neat would it be to say, hey, mom, here's the town you grew up in. Somebody LiDAR'd that town. Would you like to VR that and actually walk around? Like, that would be huge.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I love it. So cool.
Yeah.
That is amazing. Big thanks to Roy W. Nash and our community of viewers for submitting stories to us this week. Thanks for watching the Category5.tv newsroom. Don't forget to like and subscribe for all your tech news with a slight Linux bias. And if you appreciate what we do, become a patron at patreon.com/newsroom. From the Category 5.tv newsroom, I'm Sasha Rickman.